Good morning, Santa Fe. Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want to listen to it, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be talking about water in its multiform and myriad manifestations. We're going to be talking to the Galisteo Watershed Partnership and Earthworks, and we're going to be talking about liquid assets using water in the arid Southwest, which is a public symposium this weekend. Right now, I would like to welcome Annie Lux. She is the author of the book Historic New Mexico Churches, for which there will be a book signing this Friday, November 2nd, right here at the Santa Fe Baking Company from 7 to 9 in the evening. Welcome, Annie.
Hi.
This is a wonderful book, richly illustrated with color illustrations about New Mexico churches from the beginning. I mean, what is the earliest church? What are the earliest churches that you've seen here in New Mexico? When were they founded?
Well, there's obviously San Miguel, which is called the oldest church in the USA. Also, some of the Pueblo churches, like 1610, the very early part of the century.
And they've been maintained, and they still survive all these years?
Well, most of the early churches were destroyed in the Pueblo Revolt, but a couple of them, especially the church at Acoma, was not destroyed. And so it has been maintained. I mean, a lot of them have been renovated over the years.
So tell us the story about the Spanish coming in and converting the Indians and having them build their own churches.
Yeah, it's pretty wild, huh? Well, when they came in, I mean, their whole mission was to convert the Indians to Christianity. Well, the biggest part of their mission, I mean, they were also coming to look for gold and for land and everything like that. But they came in with Franciscan friars. There were 12 of them. They spread out over the state and went to the different pueblos and started preaching Christianity. And you have to remember that the Spanish were the most amazing things that the Indians ever seen. I mean, they had horses, they had armor, they were rich, they had all sorts of clothing and tools. So they went in and started preaching the gospel, and most of the Indian cultures welcomed, and you know, other cultures' spirituality, and were more than willing to incorporate it into their own beliefs. So before you know it, they were very willing to help build the churches. They were the biggest structures most of these people had ever seen. And they also improved life in a lot of ways. I mean, they introduced new farming methods, new tools, new crops. So there were a lot of benefits to the Indians, as well, obviously, as, you know, the Spanish coming in and sort of taking over their culture.
Well, one thing you point out in the book is the tension between the Franciscans, who were not really necessarily the vortex of evil, and then some of the soldiers and the military class of the Spanish, who really were brutal.
Yes, especially the first wave of the Spanish. They were quite brutal, very greedy. And they wanted the Indians as slave labor.
Right.
I mean, the Franciscans weren't completely innocent of that either. But they, especially the very early Franciscans, seemed to have higher motives. They were sincere in their beliefs.
So the churches were destroyed in the Pueblo Revolt?
Most of them, yeah. Or at least very badly damaged.
Were they specifically targeted because they represented the Spanish?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they destroyed everything. The Indians destroyed everything that belonged to the Spanish. They destroyed documents, they destroyed the churches, obviously, everything that was in the churches, even the tools. Pope, the leader of the Pueblo Revolt, even wanted to get rid of the fruit trees that the Spanish brought in, every single vestige of Spanish influence.
And then, once that was over, it started all over again.
It did. 12 years later, when Coronado came in, De Vargas. De Vargas was a much better man than Oñate and the early Spanish conquistadors. He promised the Spanish that they would not try to destroy their religion and they would not make them slave labor. And by then, the Indians had gotten quite used to Spanish protection from the nomadic Indian raids that would come in. So the Spanish were almost welcomed back, especially since they were promised that the problems that had been that had existed earlier would be repeated.
And so then they started building new churches.
Exactly.
So what are these churches like when you go around New Mexico? I mean, obviously they're not all the same. There's some little tiny, adorable, small village churches, and there are some pretty imposing structures, I suppose the most imposing of which is the cathedral in Santa Fe.
Right. Now, the little churches are not were not built by Spain. The Pueblo churches were missions that were funded by Spain and the Spanish crown. But the little Spanish churches were actually built by the communities. They had to raise the money themselves, they had to build them themselves, and decorate them themselves. That's where they're very different than the big Pueblo churches.
Were they, what were they made of? All adobe?
Yeah, they were almost all adobe.
To what extent are the small village churches, first of all, in proper repair and state of maintenance, and second, are they used?
Some of them are, some of them aren't. There are some, most of the churches these days are either being renovated or maintained in a certain way because there's been a large movement to preserve these structures.
Yeah, we had Cornerstones on not too long ago.
Yeah, they're great.
And they provide money to communities, but then
the communities themselves will go in and do the renovations. I was up at Ojo Caliente, and they were pulling off all the old stucco. There was a movement not in the like 70s where they had put stucco on top of the adobe and cement. With varying results. Some of the churches that worked out all pretty well, the church at Zia Pueblo has got stuccoed and whitewashed, and it's actually done very well. But most of them, it ends up trapping moisture underneath it, so the inside structure starts to come down and crumble. So a lot of them are pulling off that old stucco and pulling down all of the chicken wire and then re-mud plastering it.
Wow. So that's a labor of love.
Yes, it is. I mean, it was amazing when I went over to Ojo because they had the whole community out there. They had the kids. Everybody was working. They had food and, you know, getting their hands dirty and putting up the mud plaster.
You say at the beginning of the book that the history of New Mexico churches is really a walk through the history of New Mexico. To what extent do you feel that people are still really using the church as really people of faith?
Oh, to a very large extent. You know, it was very moving to me to see how lovingly a lot of the communities maintain their churches. The mayordomos would come and open them up for me, or I would stop, and if someone was around, I often would go by, and there would be somebody, you know, sweeping the church out or cleaning it, and these people were very, very attached to their churches. This is the church where they grew up, where they were baptized, where they were married, and it had been in their family for generations.
Are we talking all Catholic churches?
Yeah. Yeah, the Protestant churches didn't get built until much later.
Tell us about the Santuario de Chimayo. That's a church, of course, that is on every tourist map and is a destination of a lot of people. That was originally built on sacred ground.
That's what's said, yes, that the Tewa Indians that lived there and had moved long before the Spanish had arrived in New Mexico, that they had always considered that a sacred ground, that it had healing properties.
And so what happened then? How did a church get built?
Well, there's a couple of versions of the story. There's a... Chimayo was one of the early communities that were founded by the Spanish in the early 1600s, or actually in the mid-1600s. And Chimayo had, I think, seven different communities built around different plazas. And the one there, there was a man named Don Bernardo Abeta, who was a penitente, an hermano. And on Good Friday, he was performing his penances and prayers, and the story says that he saw a light over by the river. So he went over to see what it was, and he found a very large crucifix. So he went and got all of his neighbors and showed them the crucifix, and they took it over to the church at Santa Cruz. And then the entire congregation from Santa Cruz came back to get the big, it's a very large crucifix, and they took it very ceremoniously over to the church at Santa Cruz and put it in the altar. The next day, it was gone, and it reappeared right there at the same spot.
It reappeared where they'd found it?
Where they'd found it, and apparently this happened like three times, and finally, you know, Don Bernardo said, well, I guess it wants to stay in Chimayo, so he built a little addition onto his house so that people could come and see it, and then eventually he got permission to build a church specifically for this.
Sounds like teenage pranks to me.
Yeah, it does. There's a couple of other stories that it appeared at a donkey. A donkey just appeared, that the church was already built. The donkey appeared, and the crucifix was on the back of it. And another story...
Is this the same crucifix that's actually still there?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, it's really quite something.
And, go ahead, another story.
It's one of the, and it is, they call it Our Lord of Esquipulas. I'm not sure if I'm saying that right, but which is a shrine in South America.
I knew somebody in Peru who was an artist, and when he was a little boy, he would draw on anything he could find, and he drew a picture of a woman on a stone and then tossed it into the lake, and somebody found it and they thought it was a miraculous apparition of the Virgin Mary.
Oh, that's great.
And they still celebrate there.
I love stories
60
like that.
Years later.
Yeah.
We're talking to Annie Lux. The book is called Historic New Mexico Churches. The decorations, the santos, are some of the real treasures of these churches, and they represent a tradition that goes back hundreds of years and is very much alive today.
Oh, yeah. There's been a big revival of the Santaro-style art, which is just wonderful. What's particularly wonderful is the Santaro-style art that's in the cathedral today, because when Bishop Lamy came in, he really wasn't a big fan of the adobe churches or the Santaro-style art. And a lot of it was destroyed under him,
really?
Unfortunately. Yeah. Hmm. There's a story that the beautiful altar screen that's at San Miguel was actually painted over with white kitchen paint.
Was he a closet Protestant?
No, he was a European. He was a Frenchman. And, you know, he was used to the very elaborate kind of art instead of the very humble folk art. Which it's so beautiful and so wonderful, and I'm so glad that there's so much of it that has survived. But to him, you know, that wasn't his style. He liked the grander style of church art.
Isn't that amazing? And so these are both paintings and sculptures that are
right.
all over New Mexico.
Right. They call the sculptures are called bultos, and the paintings they're retablos, which is, you know, painting on wood, and the altar screens, the reredos are. Well, they have panels and they have, you know, wooden frames, and they're really quite elaborate and gorgeous.
Where are some of examples of that kind of artwork here in Santa Fe?
In Santa Fe, the best place to see that would be at San Miguel.
And which one is San Miguel?
The oldest church in the USA, one right on Old Santa Fe Trail.
Right, right. And tell us about the cathedral.
What about it?
It's such a huge and important structure.
Yes. Yes.
When was it built?
Well, the cathedral itself was built in the mid to late 1800s under Bishop Lamy. There had been a parish church there earlier. There was a few there earlier. One was destroyed in the Pueblo Revolt, and then one was built in 1717. And when Bishop Lamy finally got the money to build the cathedral, they built it right on top of the parish church. And when they would finish a wall, then they would take the adobe bricks down one by one and use them other places in Santa Fe. And if you go over to the La Conquistadora Chapel, that is in the back over to the left of the altar, that, you know, the statue of La Conquistadora is the oldest representation of the Virgin Mary in the New World. And the room that she's in is from the 1717 parish church. You can see the old vigas and woodwork, and they have a lot of the old art there.
So this is a work that took you driving all over New Mexico. It must have been fun.
Oh, it was great. I absolutely loved it. I got to see parts of New Mexico that I'd never seen before, these little tiny towns. I got to meet wonderful people who told me great stories. And, you know, it was a blast.
Well, this book is called Historic New Mexico Churches, and we've been talking to Annie Lux. There will be a book signing of this book this Friday, November 2nd, here at the Santa Fe Baking Company from 7 to 9 in the evening. It's published by Gibbsmith Publishers. And where is this book available? Is it in the local bookstores?
Yeah. Yeah. If it's not in all the bookstores, most of them are going to be getting it very soon. And I will have books at the book signing as well.
Well, it's wonderful to have you here. Thank you so much for coming down at this early hour.
Oh, thanks, Mary Charlotte.
We're going to take a little break right now. When we come back, we'll be talking about water. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome the folks from the Earthworks Institute. Jan Willem Janssens is here. He's the executive director of that organization. And Sig Silber is a board member, and he's on the Wetlands Steering Committee. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
We're happy to be here.
It's great to have you here. Galisteo is, tell us about Earthworks Institute, first of all.
Yeah. Ecological educators and planners who help communities here build capacity to restore, protect, and live in harmony with their natural environment. We're really capacity builders for communities to be stewards of the environment. And we've done that for about 14 years here in the Galisteo watershed, where we used to have a demonstration ranch. That ranch is now sold, but we're gradually spreading out throughout Santa Fe County in the southwest to help different communities. Really readopt their environment as stewards.
And really come to understand what watershed they're part of and what
exactly
it means to be part of that watershed.
Yes.
What does it mean for your average person living in a quarter acre lot or less to be part of a watershed?
Well, when you're part of a watershed, you're going to be impacted, particularly in terms of your water resources, in terms of anything that happens in the watershed, particularly further up towards the mountains. It's one water source. We're all using the same water.
And so how do people become part? I mean, there's an understanding. Yes, we're all using the same water. What do we actually do? How are you helping people think about it differently?
We try to make people communicate with each other so that they are hearing from different stakeholders in the communities and outside the communities what their role is. And that is, we try to bring in youth, work with local schools, government agencies, businesses, the different people who are really relying on that landscape, and bring forward certain ideas like what difference it might make actually to harvest the water locally so that it infiltrates, that you don't have to use tap water, that you try to become more self-sufficient, you could say, regarding water, but also other things, ecological resources that you have in the landscape, and live in harmony with wildlife that may even benefit from the ecological corridors or wetlands that are next to your community. And therefore, again, adopt the open spaces, the bosques, the areas that are in the community, and not think like, oh, government will take care of it. We have to do that together.
So what kind of projects are you actually doing? You're doing some watershed restoration.
Yeah, we've done a lot of watershed restoration in the Galisteo watershed, and it means really that we've been looking at streams, wetlands, riparian, meaning wet vegetated corridors along streams, and have looked up and down the Galisteo watershed, how they connect. And several years ago, we started the Galisteo Watershed Partnership as a vehicle to bring different communities together, and neighborhoods and other entities, government entities and schools, whatever you have that is important in managing that resource, to exchange information, but also to have a launching pad for new ideas, and basically a network from where we can oversee specific projects like the Wetlands Project or a large green infrastructure, natural lands protection project for the Galisteo Basin that we're working on right now.
One of the things that you're looking at is growth patterns, development growth patterns.
That's right. The health of our wetlands and streams has been enormously influenced and often compromised by growth that's happened. Started with the railroad in around 1880, and then in the last 30 to 50 years, the growth of Santa Fe County, basically. And so water extraction is one, but building of roads is another, the runoff and flooding that's associated with those patterns. And so where growth is happening has an enormous influence on what the health, potential health of the wetlands and streams is, because water extraction often reduces the amount of water that comes out of springs, because of it basically reduces groundwater flow towards those springs.
Right.
As I said, runoff from paved areas creates flash floods in the creeks and destabilizes the ecological health there.
How do you influence the way development goes? I mean, you're a nonprofit organization, and development is done by real estate developers.
Well, there are many decisions that affect how growth is going to take place in the Galisteo Basin, and one of the things we're trying to do is give the ordinary citizen a voice in how this process is going to be mediated. And I think that's where the Galisteo Watershed Partnership comes in.
Can you say more about that?
Yeah, and in addition to that, we feel that it's necessary to launch a dialogue in the 10, 14 years or so that we've been doing this. We've seen that a lot of initiatives in the watershed, both on the side of conservation and development, happened without any communication between them, also between different government agencies. They didn't talk. And so we felt the need to have a forum where we could bring together all these entities to talk and anticipate what was going to happen and what the mutual relationships are, or compatibilities and incompatibilities between the different initiatives that are being launched.
I think that's one thing that it's quite amazing you do very well is bringing so many different kinds of people together whose interests on the surface don't seem to be the same.
Yeah, we have ranchers, we have a conservation developer like the Commonweal Conservancy often attending. We have county, state, and federal representatives, and a lot of landowners or local leaders of local associations and conservation groups.
You are also having a meeting this coming Friday, the 2nd of November, at the Santa Fe Community College in the Hemes Room.
That's right.
And one of the things we're going to do there is we're going to play some what-if games. We're going to talk about, you know, what if what we want to do in the Galisteo Basin is to see a focus on the use of the existing groundwater resources and conservation of the groundwater resources, or what if we would like to see more intensive water infrastructure systems, or what if we want to minimize fossil fuel use, or what if we want to maximize open space, wildlife corridors, scenic values, and cultural historical resources? If we wish to have a certain future, what kind of decisions need to be made? What obstacles will be faced? What actions will need to be taken to get started? Who will do what, which is very important? And what partnerships will be helpful to move things in the direction that we would like to see things happen in the Galisteo Basin?
So who is invited to come? Who would benefit by going, or be of benefit by going there?
We invited, of course, all the partners, and basically everybody who feels he has a stake, or he or she has a stake in the Galisteo watershed. So that might be leaders of community associations, residents, ranchers or ranch managers, developers, business owners who are interested in the in a good local economic climate,
right,
related to growth, but also the environment that the Galisteo watershed provides to a lot of businesses. Youth, actually, if we could get youth or school groups to attend, that would be wonderful.
Another thing, and I don't think this is something that you're going to talk about at this meeting, but I just wanted to bring it up because there's a lot of conversation right now about the potential oil and gas drilling happening in Galisteo, and that surely would affect the watershed.
Yeah, it is definitely something looming over everything we're doing right now. It's very uncertain where it's going yet. But it's definitely something that we keep an eye on. We try not to mix the conversations about oil and gas development too much with this conversation, because there are parallel conversations happening in the next couple of weeks on those.
Right.
Notably, this Thursday evening at 5:30.
Yes.
It's
somebody's birthday somewhere in America, ladies and gentlemen. I'll just say right now, for those who can hear me on out in Radio Land, that this Thursday, people who are concerned about oil and gas drilling in Galisteo can go to a meeting at 5:30 at the Chavez Community Room at Chavez Community Center on Rodeo Road, and they're trying to get hundreds of people out there to talk about that subject. But I mean, when there's oil and gas drilling, that can affect the aquifers.
Yes. And, well, maybe Sig, you can say something about
that. Well, the oil and gas drilling certainly can affect the aquifers. It can affect problems with sediment erosion. It certainly can have an impact on property values. And I think one thing that people need to understand about oil and gas is this is not new. We had oil and gas exploration in the 80s, and at that time they defined certain areas of interest, and those areas of interest went from the Ortiz Mountains all the way up to the Rio Arriba County border, east over almost to El Dorado, under Agua Fria.
And what happened?
Probably the main thing that happened was the price of oil crashed, and they went away. And right now, oil is higher than it's ever been, so we have to be concerned about this, that's for sure.
So the next meeting of the Galisteo Watershed Partnership is this coming Friday, November 2nd, at 8:30 in the morning?
We start at 8:30. If people can come a little earlier so that they find a seat, then we can start in time. So we will give a little overview of what's happened at previous meeting, because we had a meeting 3 weeks ago that focused mostly on the hydrology of the Galisteo watershed and what the implications are of the findings of the hydrology for future growth. And that generated a bunch of questions and issues that we're going to explore further this coming Friday morning. And so we'll have several breakout groups so that people have a lot of opportunity to talk about different aspects.
And if people want to find out more about it or find out about the Earthworks Institute or Galisteo, is there a number that they can call?
Yeah, our phone number is 982-9806. And we're currently building our website, but the website that people can find some information on right now is nmwaterconnections.org. On Friday, we actually may have our new website for the Galisteo Partnership up, and that is galisteowatershed.org.
Well, Jan Willem Janssens, Executive Director of Earthworks Institute, and Sig Silber, also involved with Earthworks Institute, thank you so much for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break right now, and when we come back, we'll be speaking to Eric Blinman about water in ancient New Mexico. Stay tuned. I'd like now to welcome Eric Blinman. He's an archaeologist and director of the Office of Archaeological Studies for the state of New Mexico, and he's here to tell us about an upcoming symposium called Liquid Assets, Using Water in the Arid Southwest. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
So this is a very interesting combination of things that I hadn't really thought that much about, which was archaeology and contemporary water use. What do we have to learn about contemporary water use by looking back at the ancient Americas, the ancient Southwest, southwestern New Mexico?
Well, I think we've all got a myopia in terms of believing that the way we live and the environment around us has been pretty, you know, the same it was when we grew up or what we experienced when we moved to Santa Fe. And it couldn't be further from the truth. When you take a, you know, a 2,000-year perspective on how agricultural peoples have lived with water and used water in this area, suddenly you get a sense of instability and variability and even fragility that is probably useful to us as balance our sense of, I don't know, hubris might not be the right word.
Or it might.
But it's archaeology does provide a time perspective that is useful in thinking about these issues.
So how do we, first of all, study the way people who lived 1,000 years ago used water?
The biggest clue is simply in settlement pattern, where people live and how they live. Are they dependent on agriculture? Are they gathering pinyon nuts and grass seeds? But as soon as people will shift to agriculture, then all of a sudden they're faced with many of the same constraints we are. And then when we get into more elaborate situations like the Hohokam down in southern Arizona, we actually find evidence of elaborate canal systems, ways of using water that are absolutely analogous to what we use today in our acequia systems here in northern New Mexico.
Way before European contact.
Way before European contact. I think the earliest clear ditch or canal irrigation systems that we have predate AD 1 in southern Arizona, and they only become more and more elaborate after that.
So they When you have in this area such variable rainfall patterns, how did these canal systems work?
Well, the canal systems in southern Arizona were capturing all of the moisture that was falling up on the southern Colorado Plateau, the Mogollon Rim, the watersheds of the Gila Rivers and the Salt Rivers. And they were capturing that with head gates, and they were basically distributing it, that water, all across modern-day Phoenix, turning it into what today would be cotton fields and what then was corn fields.
And so was it mainly corn? Was that the main crop that was grown with this irrigation system?
Yeah, throughout the Southwest, corn was the principal source of calories. Beans and squash are secondary, but mainly it was corn. But these people were also producing cotton as the equivalent of what we today think of as a cash crop, producing textiles, using textiles for trade. So basically, once you've captured water like that for agriculture, it opens up tremendous opportunities for growth and supporting pretty large-scale and complex communities.
Groundwater was not something that they were tapping into.
No, groundwater is extremely rare in the archaeological record of the Southwest. We do have wells that were dug in the greater Phoenix area, because before the advent of modern irrigation and pumping, which lowered the aquifer, you could dig down 5 or 6 feet and find water in all of the riverbeds year-round. But for the most part, underground waters remained untapped, except where they emerged from the ground as springs.
Did they have ways of storing water?
We've got reservoirs, even here in the Santa Fe area, just south of town. Every single one of the large Galisteo Basin pueblos has some sort of water reservoir associated with it, and several of the large pueblos have multiple reservoirs. We have reservoirs up in the Four Corners area as well. There's clear evidence of using natural tanks, depressions in sandstone that would collect water after seasonal rains and use that as a persistent water source until it was used up or evaporated away.
So these irrigation systems, storage systems, and so on existed, and then what kind of, you were talking about real changes and variability. In other words, what would throw the system off balance?
In the ancient world, the first priority was always farming. You had to grow enough crops in order to survive. And in that context, most of these people, and the Ho'okam irrigators are the exception, were relying on rainfall irrigation. So they're dependent on climate. And climate is such a major variable in the Southwest. I think we've got something like 7 major climate transitions over 2,000 years that forced human populations to adapt. But those adaptations were because the climate influenced the agricultural system much more so than any consideration of potable water for domestic use.
What were some of those climate changes?
It's almost like there's 4 or 5 different modes of climate in the Southwest, but they can be broken down into combinations of how much rainfall you're getting, how variable is it from year to year, and the seasonal concentration of rainfall. Is it coming when you need it for crops? And all of those can vary. Also, the climate variable of cold affects growing season length, because when things are warm, agricultural populations can move upslope to higher elevations, can take advantage of the greater moisture that falls as rain and snow at higher elevations. But as soon as it gets cold, those higher elevations become off-limits to corn agriculture, and you have to slide down. So it's really a complex mosaic through time and geography of rainfall, the timing of that rainfall, and cold.
And so those patterns were just normal fluctuations of the chaotic universe in which we live.
If you take a long enough time span, look at it, absolutely. The change is the norm. rather than stability being the norm. I don't think there's a single period in the past 2,000 years that experienced a predictable climate for longer than five or six generations before something changed and populations were forced to adapt.
As we are being forced to adapt now, kicking and screaming.
Yeah, and we're not unique in that sense. The archaeological record is, if nothing else, it's a monument to human beings' desire to maintain the status quo. Everybody wants to believe that what they're experiencing is weather, right up to the point where they suddenly realize that what they're experiencing is climate change. Change is forced on people. People don't go, calmly into these situations. Although, right now, with our technology and our perspectives, we may have a better opportunity for what I'd call preemptive adaptation than any population has ever had in the past. And that's one reason why we're putting on this symposium.
Well, let's talk about this symposium, Liquid Assets Using Water in the Arid Southwest. You've got people coming from all over the place, academics, archaeologists, anthropologists, and people from the Pueblos and so on. One of the things that is so striking about anthropological angle is that whatever period of history you look at in the Southwest, the population doesn't begin to compare to the population we have now, so the numbers are just so different.
Yeah, we definitely, though we can learn from the past in terms of looking at it, the problems we face today are absolutely unique to today. Today we're relying on groundwater. That wasn't an issue before. Today, in the past, the agricultural needs of a community were the principal driver, but that community participated in the agriculture. That's not true today.
Right.
Today, we can not only move water physically, but we can move water rights in a legal sense from place to place, so that Santa Fe is contemplating pulling water out of the Colorado River Basin, which is basically pulling water out of the Pacific to put into the Atlantic. These are...
Is that right?
Yeah.
Because we're on the other side of the continent.
That's right. So it's this, we have remarkable potentials that didn't exist in the past. But that you can look at it in two ways. One, it's a tremendous tool to find solutions. On the other hand, it's a tremendous crutch that then allows us to create problems that may be much more difficult to solve in subsequent generations.
What is the value then in looking back at the ancient Southwest?
I think the biggest value of this perspective is really the recognition that what we are facing today isn't unique at all. That populations, communities have faced these sorts of issues before, and that we need to deal with them. All of these other groups that we can look at in archaeological time went through some sort of collapse. If we can design our own collapse, if you will, if we design a soft collapse, we can preserve more of our expectations, more of our way of life. We can, create sort of a new cultural adaptation to these situations. We don't have to repeat some of the calamities, if you will, that happened in the past.
What did some of those calamities look like?
Well, the first and solution of choice for everybody is movement. Mass migration out of areas where you could no longer make a living into areas where you could. As populations increased on the landscape, movement was less and less of an opportunity. It put you in conflict with populations that were already in places that had adequate water. And so conflict is a major element of past adaptations. Population decline. If you try to maintain your population in place too long, you put your entire community at risk of disease, of malnutrition, higher mortality that's associated with that, completely independent of conflict. So there are all kinds of negative consequences that can go with change. And again, that's one of the things that looking forward would hope to minimize.
Well, it's certainly something that people talk about in terms of climate change because there are many places that will become uninhabitable because they will be covered with water, and they're looking forward to millions of climate change refugees by the middle of this century.
I think that's absolutely true. The worst case scenarios are millions. Whether or not the worst case scenarios come true is something that we won't know till the time. The adjustments of population are going to be extreme. The hardest thing for everyone to take right now is that all we have to predict exactly what that future will look like are models. And models are totally dependent on the assumptions on which they're built. So the models may be completely accurate when viewed 100 years from now, or they may have missed by a mile 100 years from now. I think the only thing we can count on is that all of these populations around the world are going to have to adapt, and some of the adaptations is going to be abandonment of huge areas. But at the same time, southern Greenland is greening up. As the ice sheet retreats, the Inuit have greater possibilities for an economy that they've never had before, including having vegetable gardens. So there's... there are up and downsides to all of this, and populations will suffer, and some populations will do relatively well.
So, what are some of the ways in which the information that you guys are talking about at a symposium like this filters into present day thinking? You know, policy making and the general discussion about climate change.
Hopefully, it figures into it by raising the broad public awareness that these are issues, that these are issues that have substance, and these are issues that we can take real action to address on a step-by-step basis in our daily lives. Our political leadership is in the most difficult position possible because no politician will ever get elected by telling everybody that we have to immediately cut back our standard of living and raise taxes and invest in whole new infrastructure. I mean, no politician is going to make it. Basically, the people have to take the lead in doing this, and then the politicians will take comfort in that and find a way to provide the administrative leadership to execute it. But it's really from the ground up that we put information and tools in the public's hands so that all of us can make decisions. Plus, right now, I think that the collective imagination of communities really is going to provide the solutions to these problems rather than the solutions imposed by any individual.
By today's White House?
Today's White House or even today's technologist. That no individual controls enough information to be right. And so it's going to be compromises between the interests of many, many, many people and communities. And that's one of the tensions of this play out in some of the talks that are being given in the symposium.
I think it's striking to me how far the gap is between what people want to happen and what they actually do. So I was talking to a friend who loves to talk about how poorly our country is doing on global warming, and he did not know that the dryer was the greatest contributor to global warming in his household.
We all have these wonderful sort of myopias of what we take for granted, those parts of our lifestyles that are the last things that we would both recognize as being contributory to the problem and the last things that we might want to give up if we were forced to change. It is fascinating that way. We are, in our current society, we're so far removed from energy use that, you know, we're not even aware what in our houses are draining down our electric meter. And it would take probably a lot of education, a lot of experimentation for even me to figure out what in my house it would make most sense to shut off.
Well, I have to say, I had a super nerdy friend who actually figured this out through using an electric meter and so on, that if he put his computer and iPod and a couple of other things on a power strip and turned it off when he wasn't using them, that cut his electricity bill by a third.
There's amazing conveniences.
Even things that are not used at all. Like you put the TV in the... Anyway.
Yeah, the idea that you have a remote control. The only reason a remote control works is that your device that you're powering on and off is really powered on all the time.
Exactly.
Because it has to be sitting there waiting for that little wake-up call from the device in your hand that's powered by the battery. So those devices, even though they appear to be off, are simply resting. And while they're resting, they're still sucking juice off the net.
They're still metabolizing.
And those, it's interesting, though. If we just think about energy use in our society, we have a remarkable amount of waste that we can cut with minimal effect on our standard of living. And I think that's one of the saving graces of the excesses of the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, is that technology has put us in a position where we're squandering a hell of a lot, and we can recover that without too much trouble.
So the public is invited to this symposium, Liquid Assets. It's Saturday, this Saturday, the 3rd of November, right here in Santa Fe. Where is it and when?
It's being held at the Armory for the Arts, 1050 Old Pecos Trail, next to the Children's Museum. We're going to start promptly at 9, and it'll carry on through 5.
Promptly at 9, Santa Fans.
Yeah. The speakers, we've packed it with speakers, and we've got 9 people, and we've only got an hour for lunch. We've trying to recoup the costs. We have support from the Thaw Charitable Trust and from the Old Santa Fe Foundation, but there is a cost involved. Would love to have people pre-register for it so that we know how much space there is. And they can register for the symposium by leaving their name and number at the Museum of New Mexico Foundation hotline. And that's 992-2715, extension 8. And one of our volunteers will give a call back and collect information from them.
And this is co-sponsored by the Museum of New Mexico, Friends of Anthropology, and the School for Advanced Research.
Yep.
What are you? We've got a minute left. What are you going to be talking about?
I'm going to be trying to bridge the past to the present and really focusing on the differences in water use and expectations for water use in the past versus those of the present as we move from the morning sessions, which really emphasize archaeological topics, into the afternoon sessions, which include treatments of, the pollution of water, Native American rights in the face of that, and the modern legalistic use of water in the division between the United States and Mexico.
So, Eric Blinman, I want to thank you very much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. And Eric Blinman is an archaeologist and director of the Office of Archaeological Studies for the Museum of New Mexico. And Liquid Assets, Using Water in the Arid Southwest, the number for more information is 992-2715. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Hoedown. Tomorrow, we are talking to Valerie Plame Wilson. Valerie Plame, the outed former CIA agent who has written a new book called Fair Game. And we'll be with her for the whole entire hour on tomorrow's Santa Fe Radio Cafe. So keep your dial tuned to KSFR 101.1 FM and 90.7 FM, Santa Fe's only public radio station. Hasta la vista. Ciao.